Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a wonderful show for you this evening. AOPA's new CEO and president, Darren Pleasance, is here, and we are going to talk about his aviation story, what brought him to AOPA, and what course he will be charting for the future of that great organization. Before we get started, just a few things. We have aviation events just booming inside Social Flight. It is still the end of February, and yet we can just begin to start to look forward to spring. And you can see all these events getting populated inside Social Flight, both upcoming fly-ins, pancake breakfast, everything you can possibly imagine, tons of educational events. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, and all you need to do is go to socialflight.com or download the free Social Flight mobile app for Apple and Android devices. In addition to that, we have wings courses. So if it is still cold and rainy or snowy in your part of the world, you can just go and head on to Social Flight and check out all these different courses in our FAA Learning Center, where you can watch and automatically get credit with the FAA safety team for your wings program. If you are a mechanic, you can participate in the Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards program. And if you happen to be an AMP mechanic with an inspection authorization, well, it is that time every 2 years when it is time for your IA renewal. And the renewal process involves, in most cases, getting 8 hours of continuing education, all of which is available for free at socialflight.com in our FAA Learning Center. You get a legal certificate you use for your IA renewal. It's all there. And even if you're not a mechanic, you may want to go check out those courses and learn some really fantastic things about maintaining aircraft and becoming a safer aircraft pilot and owner if you happen to own an aircraft. Lastly, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset to Robert Kelly of Kachujiak, Alaska. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, Robert. My apologies otherwise, but I think it's probably made better by the brand new headset that you've got there. And we are now giving away another one. And all you need to do is get the free Social Flight mobile app and check in at your local airport. You get points at every airport you check in at. And if you check in, even once you're entered in to win, if you check in multiple times and get on our leaderboard, you can get extra entries into that drawing. And again, we've got another one coming up after this. On April 1st, we are giving away another Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. And tonight's program is brought to us by Lightspeed Aviation and that amazing Delta Zulu headset. It has the Canary carbon monoxide detection and hearing acuity, customized audio. I'll have to tell you, if you ever check, I write the column for maintenance online for AOPA, and I did a story about how we found a carbon monoxide leak in our aircraft, and it was using that Lightspeed Delta Zulu, where it alerted us, and then we found that the muffler was failing. And so some good information, some pictures, and more information about how you can inspect your system and fly safer with something like that. Now on to tonight's program. I'm so excited. Now on January 1st, Darren Pleasance took over as AOPA's CEO and president, becoming the sixth CEO in AOPA over the past 85 years. Isn't that some number? Six different presidents over an 85-year period. That to me is some real staying power and stability, which elevates the importance of the position and the reins that Darren is taking over. Darren's story echoes that of many in the aviation community, from model planes to being a ramp rat at the local airport, hoping to exchange labor on the ground for time in the air. And Darren was able to do that and soloed at 16, got his private at 17, his commercial instrument and CFI at 18, while also going to college for his degree in mechanical engineering. Although being in the cockpit was his first love, he ended up deciding that his best path would be a career in business, ultimately making partner at the global management consulting firm McKinsey & Company, followed by leadership positions at Google and Cisco Systems. But Throughout his career, he never lost sight of aviation. He served on the board of EAA for the past 14 years and remained highly active in aviation just about every way possible. He currently flies a Sea Ray, an RV6, a Piper Meridian, a North American T6 Texan, and a North American P-51 Mustang. So if that collection of aircraft doesn't span the gamut of aviation and speak to just about everyone out there, I do not know what does. He also recently published a book that we're going to talk about tonight, True North, a Handbook for Inspired Living, that became a bestseller on Amazon and has served as a foundation for a lot of the public speaking that Darren does today. I'm thrilled to have him with us tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, AOPA President and CEO, Darren Pleasance.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how are you doing, Darren?
I'm great, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know you have been very, very busy diving into this role that you've been in still for a fairly short amount of time. I saw you briefly out at Buckeye. You were, I guess, on the West Coast yesterday. You're back in Frederick now. Tell me a little bit of what it's been like diving into the role.
Yeah, like you said it well, I'm drinking from the fire hose. There's in addition to the commitments that the organization had for things like, as you mentioned, Buckeye was last week. I was at the Northwest Aviation Conference up in Seattle this last weekend. Also, the Washington Seaplane Pilots Association had a nice fundraising dinner on Friday night of last week. And I can't even remember, I spoke at the Cirrus event, I think on my second day on the job down in Florida, and so on. So there's a lot of external stuff that is required of the role, which I get a lot of energy from. So it's not that difficult a requirement. But then there's also just the day job. There's a lot of stuff with Washington, D.C. And obviously with some of the accidents that have happened, there's a lot of attention and eyes on D.C. So I'm spending quite a bit of time with our team at AOPA that work very closely with folks on Capitol Hill and with directly with the FAA. And then there's with the team here in Frederick as well. And that's, thinking about our agenda and how do we need to craft and tune it so that we build the most compelling aviation organization in the world so that everybody wants to be a member of it.
Certainly makes sense. And you are obviously taking on a storied role. And so it's very exciting to be able to look forward. I'd like to start by looking backward a little bit so that people get to know you. I mentioned a few things in the introduction, but take me back. And did you come from an aviation background or were you kind of an outsider? What brought you into aviation and ultimately all the way to the reins of AOPA?
Yeah, so I did not come from an aviation background. My parents were not in aviation at all, and nor did they particularly like general aviation. But I managed to get into model airplanes, as you said in your intro, when I was about 12 or 13, happened to see a fellow flying a model airplane at a local field. And I stopped to watch, and he noticed my interest and called me over and ended up inviting me back to his house with his nephew to build model airplanes. We did that for many years, which introduced me to it. I was in Boy Scouts, and I discovered there was an aviation merit badge option. So I started pursuing that, and our scout leader was a CFI, it turned out, coincidentally. And so I got my first airplane ride in a 172 with my scout master. And I was fortunate enough in Livermore, California to live about 5 miles away from the Livermore airport. So I could take my bike, and I was only 13 at the time, so I could ride my bike to the airport. And this was pre-fence days. You know, now it's a lot harder for sure these days, but I could just ride up and down between the hangars and spot somebody working on their airplane and hover outside, and inevitably most of them would see me and invite me in to help them do whatever they were doing. And you do that enough, and pretty soon someone offers you an airplane ride, and that became the start of it. And then, as you said, I ended up getting enough experience. By the time I was 16, I'd already been flying for a few years in various types of airplane, mostly tailwheel airplanes. So I was able to solo at 16, and then got my private, and so on. And then all the way through college, I was a flight instructor while going to school. The flight instructing outfit that I worked for had a charter component. So I started tagging along on 135 charter flights in Senecas and Navajos and things like that. Built up enough time to where I was able to qualify for their Part 135 operation. So I got checked out and got my 135 certificate, and I was able to start flying in Senecas and various types of aircraft like that. And I was kind of lucky, right place, right time. John Travolta lived in Santa Barbara at the time and had a Hawker jet, Hawker Siddeley 125, and needed a right seat guy when he didn't want to fly. And so I had the opportunity to do that as basically a backup pilot to him. And then went and saw a presentation one day with the guy from a guy who flew in Alaska and was an Alaska bush pilot by summer and a physics professor by school year. And it just lit this fire in me about how cool would that be to go to Alaska and become a bush pilot. And so I took a leave of absence from school at that point. I was in my master's stage of my engineering classes then, and went to Alaska and ended up getting a job and flew all over Alaska, got to see pretty much the whole state, and then came back and got hired to fly corporate jets for about 6 years before heading off into that world that you described of business with McKinsey and Google and Cisco. So that's been my aviation journey. Since then, I got into competition aerobatics as well, into warbirds. I towed gliders to earn money over the summers when I was in college. So a lot of different types of flying. Only thing I really haven't done much of, a little bit, but not much of, is helicopters. Pretty much everything else is pretty deep.
Wow, that's awesome. We have a few kind of photos. Why don't you take me through a little bit? And I put a big smile on my face because this is a good place to start.
Yeah, that would have been back in the, I was probably 14 years old, because while I was starting to do real airplanes, full-size airplanes, I was still doing model airplanes. This is Livermore, California. And as a kid out there in the mornings on Saturdays, flying my model airplane, a little more hair than I have now.
It is, you know, those are the days when those planes were really hard to fly.
Oh yeah, and you had to really build them, right? Then nowadays, a lot of foam stuff out there. These were all balsa wood, so you had ribs, and you had to, you know, use the super glue basically, and the monocoat, and all the stuff you used to build them. And that was back when craft radios really reigned supreme. Then Futaba and Airtronics and others came out, and so yeah. The world has changed a lot since those days. But boy, what a great experience!
No auto stabilization or anything like that.
No.
I recognize this man. Here's someone who's been on the show.
Yeah, and he hasn't aged. I don't know what the deal is, what deal he made with somebody, but he looks the same today as he did back then. This would have been in 1996 when that picture was taken, and I was living in Boston at the time, where I think you are, Jeff.
Yes.
And I had gone out there. This was after graduate school. It's when I joined McKinsey. I was living in Boston, and I still had been flying. I've been doing aerobatics really since I was a kid. And so I went out and got checked out at Michael's school, but he was also looking for a flight instructor to teach people how to do aerobatics, competition aerobatics. And so he had a fleet of decathlons and then this extra 200 that were sitting on there. And so we became good friends, and we're still good friends to this day. And he's also has been on the EAA board for a long time. And I just stepped off the EAA board in taking this job at AOPA. But Michael and I have been good friends for many years, really starting back when this picture was taken in the just slightly after the mid-90s.
So you actually taught underneath Mike Goulian.
I did, yeah. So he was
something. And by the way, you're 100% right. He doesn't age at all, but there's a painting that does age in one of his hangars, but no one gets to see it.
Yeah, it was really cool. And obviously, he's just a great person as a human being, but he obviously is an amazing pilot as well. And so having a chance to fly with him and fly for him and teach people at his school, and it really set the foundation for what happened to me later, where I became the president of IAC Chapter 38, which is the Northern California Aerobatic Club. Had I not worked for Michael and gotten experience in competition aerobatics, I'm sure the California experience when I went back to the West Coast in 1998, that wouldn't have happened. And I ended up becoming the president of that chapter and grew it into the largest chapter in the country, which is what ended up getting the attention of Tom Poberesny and the group at Oshkosh at EAA. And they asked me to join the IAC board at that time. I did that for probably 5 years or so. And then the folks at EAA, Tom Poberesny in particular, asked me if I would join the EAA board. So that experience with Michael is what led to that whole journey up through the world of EAA.
Wow. Well, Mike Goulian, if you're listening, your ears must be burning. Okay.
That was a great experience.
I like this.
Yeah, that was me. I used to fly home. I, you know, as anybody who's early in their flying career is trying to do, I was trying to build time, and I was going to school in Santa Barbara. My parents lived in Livermore still. And so I would find any opportunity I could on a weekend to see if I could round up some other kids from the college there. And this was a Cherokee I was flying. It was a Cherokee Archer, and fly up to the Bay Area, and I could share the cost with them. And so I got, you know, a substantially reduced expense from the local FBO, where I could share the cost of renting an Archer for the weekend, and I'd fly up on Fridays and usually fly home sometimes Sunday afternoon. But it was, you know, 3 hours each way, something like that, so I could get 6 hours of flying each weekend. And this was obviously a wet, rainy day it looked like there in Livermore when my mom took that picture as I was about to head back to Santa Barbara.
That's absolutely awesome. And so there, talk about some interesting aircraft.
Yeah, this was, I had a Pitts S1S was my first airplane that I ever owned when I finally had enough money to own a plane. And I bought that, I did competition in that. And then as anybody who's done competition knows, at some point you wanna have something higher performance that'll do, have more vertical capabilities. And a fellow from the West, from the East Coast, from the New England area, Hans Bach, had built that airplane. In fact, if you look at the end number, it says 230 Hotel Bravo. That was Hans did this beautiful job building that airplane. And I'd met that group when I was doing competition aerobatics out in the New England area when I worked for Mike. And so I heard this was for sale and I reached out to Hans and he was willing to sell it to me. And he flew it across the country to California. And so that's a picture just outside of Livermore, California, flying that. And I owned that for quite a few years. And then it got handed down to other people inside the same aerobatic chapter that I had been the president of. Northern California Aerobatic Club.
What aircraft is it?
It's a Laser 230. So it's basically Leo Loudenslager used to fly one of those many, many years ago. And it's, you know, you can call it a poor man's extra if you want. It's an IO360. This was pumped up. So you can see the single exhaust there. It's got a 4-to-1 exhaust. It's got 10-to-1 compression pistons, cold air induction, had a 2-blade MT prop on it at the time. And so it was a, you know, super performer for, you know, nowhere near the cost of what a, you know, an Edge would cost or an Extra would cost. So it's, you know, not as high performing as an Edge or Extra, and it doesn't have all the carbon that those airplanes would have, but it's a pretty darn high performing airplane and a ton of fun to fly.
That's awesome. And then here's just, I think we have one or well, basically one more.
Yeah, this one was, this is early, this is shortly after I soloed. One of the benefits of having been at the local airport since I was 13, by the time I was 16, I'd been there for 3 years. So I'd gotten to know pretty much everybody, and they've been such amazing mentors, and I've been doing lots of aerobatics and lots of tailwheel flying, and I was surprised actually how many of them would offer me their airplanes to fly. So this was a fellow that was based at the airport there, and he had this Jodel. It's a you know, little home built yellow airplane with a Volkswagen Bug engine on it, 35 horsepower if I'm not mistaken. And hand prop, there's no electrical system in it. And so he let me use this. So a group of folks, the fellow in the background with his blue decathlon, a guy named Dave Dugan, we all flew over to Tracy. So this picture was taken in Tracy, California. And I was lucky, right? I was young. I would have been somewhere in my 16, you know, 16 years old, basically, just coming up on getting my private license and had a chance to fly lots of different kinds of planes like that one.
That's absolutely wonderful. I mean, fun. There's something about, I think, coming up with that type of an experience and now being in the role that you're in that gives you an opportunity to say, how can we get a little bit about that back? Like, I treasure that this is where you're coming from, because I think it makes such a difference in what the vision is as to where we could be going to.
Yeah, I am highly appreciative of the journey I've had. And it was, you know, so shaped by other people who were willing to invest time and give me opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise had, especially not coming from an aviation family. There wasn't any natural way for me to get those experiences. But I think this is universally true. Most pilots want to give back and share what they love about aviation with other people. It is harder with the fences around airports. I think part of, you know, my commitment, and I think the opportunity with through AOPA is to help create more access to the kinds of experiences I've had, and I know many others have had, and then encourage others out there who have the opportunity to do what we all love doing to share that with other people. And I was definitely the beneficiary of that in so many ways, because what you showed were lots of cool, interesting tailwheel airplanes, but I had equally compelling experience with people, like I mentioned earlier, taking me up in Senecas and Navajos and eventually jets and turboprops and lots of other types of airplanes and then warbirds and these other things. So I managed to accumulate experiences across so many types and dimensions of aviation. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, pretty much all of it was because somebody saw an interest and liked the fact that I was excited about it and was willing to basically open a door I could step into. And so for me, that's, you know, how do I take advantage of the footprint that AOPA has in the industry to do that at scale? And so that'll be a big part of the agenda going forward is, you know, how do we use AOPA's reach and scale to help create more opportunities for people who, you know, could have an experience similar to the one that I had.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I want to go a little bit further through your journey here before we just dive into topics. I don't know what to say about this one. You tell me.
Yeah, it's funny. I ended up going to Alaska, as I mentioned. I just went door to door, started up in Fairbanks and knocking on doors. And most of the jobs in Fairbanks that I came across were hauling fuel, in like DC-6s around the state. And that sounded fun and interesting and cool, but they wanted like a year commitment to do it. And I already had a job back in already lined up in September at the end of that season. I went to Talkeetna and had a great opportunity to do some flying with K2 Aviation there. And Jim Okunek was the fellow who owned K2 at the time. And they had 185s and other Beavers and other airplanes. I flew with him for just a little bit. And Jim at the time was looking for someone to stay on through hunting season, which was into the fall. And in parallel, since I had reached out trying to find different companies that might hire me, I had reached out to a company called Wilbur's Flight Service in parallel to when I started my trip up there. And they had reached out saying, hey, if you're in the Anchorage area, swing by and let's see whether there could be an opportunity. So I did. I left Talkeetna early in that season and came down to Anchorage. And they had Senecas and 402s primarily. They had a few other airplanes, but mostly it was Senecas and 402s. And I did a check ride with them, and they seemed to like me and hired me on. It ended up being a great opportunity because they were based at Merrill Field in Anchorage, but they had contracts for servicing the entire state. So it let me get out to the Aleutian Islands and up to Prudhoe Bay and Barrow and the places in the northern parts of Alaska and out to Kotzebue and Nome out to the west and all over basically. And so this is a picture in the Prince William Sound. We had a uniform we had to wear. So that's not a typical bush pilot uniform, but that's what we wore at Wilbur's. And you had to carry a gun with you at state law. You had to have some kind of protection as well as a emergency kit that went with the airplane in case you were, in case you had to land in the hinterlands of Alaska. It's a pretty barren place out there without a lot of people around. So you might be hours, if not days, before someone came across you. So this was just me. I dropped somebody off at a Native Alaskan village and had my shotgun with me that day, and somebody got the picture.
That's awesome. And so rounding out some of the planes that you've done, we go to the other end. This is yours now, is that correct?
It is mine now. Yeah. So there's a. I've got partners in pretty much every airplane I fly now. I found that that works pretty well because I can't fly them all at the same time, and it helps for airplanes to fly more regularly than I can do on my own. And so, so this there's two other fellows and myself. Yeah, there's three of us total in this airplane. It's a Sea Ray, out of built in from a company down in Florida. They're unfortunately bankrupt right now. Hopefully, they'll come back to life because the Sea Ray itself is a wonderful airplane. It's a light sport, has a turbocharged Rotax pusher on the top wing. You can't really see it in the picture there, but it's a great airplane, super fun to fly, 4.5 or 5 gallons an hour. So just a kick if you want to go out and land on water or take off and land on land, as you can see with the wheels. So it's a complete amphib setup and inexpensive and super fun.
Absolutely love that. And this is a shot of you flying it too.
Yeah, I live in Bend, Oregon these days. So even though I grew up in the Bay Area and worked in the Bay Area and went to school in Southern California, in about 2004 or so, we moved up to Bend, Oregon, and which is also a very deep aviation part of the world because Lance Nibauer's from there. Lance Air was created there. Epic is based there today. There's a startup jet company called Stratus that's based there. So a lot of interesting aviation stuff, and that's where this the Sea Ray lives, is in Bend. And this was just taken a week ago or so. The
Oh.
snow, the mountains, the Cascade Mountains are just 10 miles or so west of where I live, and this was just a nice day. There was too much ice on the lakes to feel comfortable going out and landing on them, so I thought rather than lake landing, I would go up and do mountain flying.
That's fantastic. And the last one that I want to make sure that we hit on, because there's got to be a story behind this before we just dive into happenings at AOPA, is how do you find your way solo, by the way, in the cockpit of a P-51 Mustang?
Yeah, certainly luck plays a big role in these things, but this was a situation where there's that old definition that luck is when experience meets opportunity, or preparedness meets opportunity, whatever you want to call it. But I think most of us who fly probably dream of someday having a chance to fly a P-51, and it's usually just a dream because the chance of that ever happening is often close to zero. There aren't that many left, and to find yourself in a place where someone's willing to let you fly one, unless you got lots of money and you want to go buy your own, that's certainly an option, but that's a pretty hefty price tag these days. But I had always focused on tailwheel time. I love tailwheel flying, and I had the opportunity a number of years ago, probably at least 10 or 12 years ago, to start flying a T6, and it was not lost on me that having T6 time was a prerequisite to any chance of flying a Mustang. And so as soon as I got the chance to fly in the T6, I took advantage of it. I ended up joining the CAF, the Commemorative Air Force, became a pilot sponsor in a T6 or an SNJ, kind of the same thing, that was based in Livermore that was not flying. It was sitting on flat tires. And so I bought into that. That wasn't very expensive. You can become a pilot sponsor of an airplane in the CAF for not that much money, like in the single digit thousands. And I did that and became the sole pilot of a T6 for several years and got a lot of T6 time, and then joined another group that had a T6, and I flew that one for quite a few years. And so just took advantage of every opportunity I could to just keep building time in a T6, which, by the way, is quite fun. So not only am I building time for some potential eventuality of coming across a Mustang, but also having a blast doing it. And then one day the phone did ring, and it wasn't, you know, the fantasy is I'm at an airport and somebody lands a Mustang and they've got to run off and they're going to ask me to fly their Mustang somewhere else. Well, it didn't quite turn out that way. But instead I got the phone call that said, hey, we have a group, a small group, as part of a museum that has a Mustang, and they try to keep the group small because they don't want the airplane to fly too much, but it can't be so small that they don't have enough people to fly it and to maintain it and pay for the inevitable things that need to get done on an 85-year-old airplane. And so they asked me to come and interview, and what is already a long story short, they ended up deciding that I would be a good candidate for, you know, for being part of the club. And so I went in, and even with as much T6 time as I had that the club required, you get another 25 hours in their T6. So you can see in the background of that picture, that gray T6 past the Mustang prop. So I flew that airplane for 25 hours, which might have been maybe as long as even a couple of years. I can't remember how long it took me to get 25 in that. But then once we did that, then I was able to make the transition into the Mustang. And it's a beautiful airplane. It's not been completely refurbished like some, but it's in nice shape. It's got a relatively new engine. It's, you can see the paint, it's in nice shape, and it's, you know, just, it's everything you would imagine it is to fly. It's amazing to have almost 1500 horsepower, you know, in your left hand as you take off. And the Merlin sounds cool from the outside. It sounds equally cool from the inside, different tone, but equally cool from the inside.
So what are some of the differences in flying the Texan versus the Mustang? I have asked this question and heard these different answers from different pilots, and including one that was on our show recently that flew it in World War II. So tell me, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I've talked to lots of pilots who have flown it in World War II. You know, a lot of people will, that's sort of that cliche, I guess, at this point around, you know, the Mustang is a good trainer for the T6, which is probably true. The T6 is for sure a harder airplane to fly. The T6 has closer landing gear. It's a the tail gets blanketed when the tail comes down, the wing blankets the tail. There's definitely been a lot of ground loop incidences with T6s. So they are definitely a challenge, and they're underpowered in a sense. So it's a heavy, relatively underpowered airplane. Whereas the Mustang has really wide landing gear. It's a super stable airplane. It's got a longer fuselage that just provides, you know, makes for a much more stable platform. That being said, there's certainly been accidents over the years in Mustangs that have resulted in loss of life. And it's a giant engine. When you learn to fly, what I love about the Mustang is it brings every aerodynamic force that you learn about, and, you know, 10x's it. So if you think about torque, if you think about slipstream effect, if you think about P factor, if you think about gyroscopic precision, we learn about those when you're in a 152 or whatever your favorite training airplane is. And they don't really show up in any big way. In this airplane, they show up in a really big way. And every single one of those forces makes that nose want to go left. And so you dial in 6 degrees of right rudder for takeoff, and that's a pretty important thing to do. Otherwise, you know, you're on your rudder a lot more. And then you don't do things fast. You don't cob the power if you have to do a go around, because the amount of torque at a slow speed can be quite dangerous. So there's those types of things. And, you know, and it's a fast airplane. It's hard to keep it under 250 knots indicated. And we know that below 10,000 feet, you have to be under 250. And that's not an easy airplane to keep under 250. So you're constantly having to watch that. So, but otherwise, it's a dream to fly. And I'm sure the folks, the fellow you said you interviewed from World War II, I'm sure he would have echoed that. It's such a nicely balanced, just fun, gentleman's kind of airplane to fly. And you can see why it did so well back in World War II.
Yeah, well, Bill Tiger Lyons at 100 years young was here on our show talking about it, and who I also spent quite a bit of time with in person, and he always, because they came up through all the different planes very, very quickly during wartime, and I always asked him, like, well, okay, why did you become a fighter pilot, bomber pilot? Like, what made the difference between? And he said, we were all together, and it was really simple. All the students that paid attention to what they were being told and followed the rules became bomber pilots, and the rest of us yahoos became fighter pilots.
That's funny. I'm sure there's some truth in that.
So I'd like to talk about now your role and what you kind of see, what you've stepped into and what's going on. So Mark Baker has been here on the show a number of times in the past. And of course, we came to where we are now with the reauthorization bill, changes to basic med, Mosaic still now being in the process. Like, Eagle, tell me what's happening now, and then we'll talk about in a little bit where you would like to take things.
Yeah, those are all, you know, I'll call it forces at work that we still have to continue to navigate. So as you mentioned, Mosaics, you know, almost across the line, but it's not quite across the line. There's some final questions on stall speed that are being, you know, debated. And once that gets finalized, our expectation is it gets finalized this summer. But, you know, in the current administration, who knows, right? There's so much turbulence. So a lot of our focus will be on doing everything we can within AOPA and in partnership with all the other alphabets, EAA and MBAA and GAMBA and others, to get that across the line. But that's definitely a big one. ADS-B is becoming a bigger and bigger deal in several fronts. One, you know, we're seeing increasing examples of where it's being used for, you know, questionable enforcement action. Many have heard about it being used in certain circumstances for landing fees. We've seen frivolous lawsuits being filed with, you know, somebody who sees the ADS-B data. This is an actual example up in Seattle where they saw that and they filed a lawsuit for mental anguish against a pilot who flew over their house, and they got that data from the ADS-B. So, you know, we want ADS-B to be used for what it was intended, which was safety, traffic, you know, eliminating traffic conflict, and then obviously efficiency. Part of it is around how do we help maximize the efficiency of aircraft in the airspace. So we're seeing examples where it's not being used for those purposes, and our fear is that because of that, we start to see unintended behaviors with people increasingly pulling breakers and turning off their ADS-B, which completely defeats the whole purpose. The whole idea is keep ADS-B on so we minimize traffic conflicts in particular. And so we're going to fight that battle and try to make sure that ADS-B gets used for the purposes it was intended. So that's another one. The FAA Reauthorization Act from last year got approved, and the FAA is now tasked with implementing that. So just making sure that the intentions within there, for which there was a lot of benefit for general aviation, make sure that actually gets implemented. One of those areas of benefit is around basic med that you just mentioned. So AOPA played a huge role, as you know, in basic med, and Mark Baker personally played a big role in helping get basic med across the line. This most recent year, it got up, so it went to 12,500 pounds. It went to 7 seats, not 6. So we want to make sure that you know, that sticks, and it should. We want to now get it into Canada, so there's active conversations in Canada to basically get a degree of reciprocity so we can bring our basic med pilots up to Canada and they can fly freely there. The Canadians are working on their own version of basic med, and the expectation would be that either it looks identical to ours or very close to ours, and we'd have a reciprocity with their pilots coming into the U.S. So working on that. Unleaded fuel.
Can we pause on that for a minute?
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about that, because that, so basic med, obviously, big changes that just went into effect that have, as you mentioned, you listed some of them off, a big impact. Yeah. Certainly, for those of us in the kind of the northern parts of the country, the whole span that's anywhere near the border with Canada, that's been an issue for quite some time, people going to basic med is growing, and that yet that really, really limits your ability to go across there. Do you see, is there really any movement there? Because it seemed like Canada had basically said, you know what, we're just going to wait and see when the whole world does it as part of...
it's a great question. We're trying to do a call it top-down, bottom-up approach. The top-down, we are working with ICAO as well to push at that level, so it's called the global level, to get an alignment around what a basic med would be at the global level. With if we can get that, then that would come more tops down and put pressure on the Canadians to essentially have their version of it, and we push it that way. And then the other way is more bottoms up, where we're working with the federal air surgeon here, Susan Northrup, and her team to directly engage with the counterparts basically up in Montreal to work with them. And there is motion. They're actually working on it right now. And the main pushback they've had is that they want to have their own. They don't want to just take our basic med and basically copy. And that would be, of course, from our vantage point, the easiest thing to do. Don't reinvent the wheel. Just take something that's working. And we have all the data, all the statistics to show that it works great. There's no degradation in safety. Let's just go ahead and bring that to the Canadians and adopt that. But they want to do, there may be some tweaks they want to make with theirs. We have to give them time to do that. But we're pushing to see if we can get that done this year. So there is motion. There's an intention to get it done as quickly as we can. I'd love to see it happen this year. And we'll just stay on it and continue to push it and make sure people don't forget about it.
Is that realistic, like 1 year? Or do you think we're looking...
Well, they've been working on it. It's not like they're about to get started. They've been working on it. And so, and once they lock on it, the reciprocity part is simple. Simple as anything happens in government. But all we have to do, the two governments have to just agree that these are close enough to each other that we're willing to let them come here and they're willing to let us go there. It's as simple as that. And we know there's no safety issue, right? There's no safety of flight issue that we're talking about. It's purely, political / regulatory and just getting all the I's dotted and T's crossed. That being said, now that we are, imposing tariffs on Canada and doing all these other things, who knows whether that negatively impacts our ability to get this done. So that's why everything I'm saying comes with this giant asterisk or caveat that it's really hard to know whether the stuff that's happening through the administration side of things is going to positively or negatively. There might be some stuff where it accelerates things for us. I know the administration's definitely favorable for a smaller government, less regulation kind of environment. So that could be helpful for us in some areas. But it could also result in topics like this that perhaps it slows down for sort of unintended consequences of some of these actions that they're taking. So we really don't know. So the best we can do is to stay highly engaged. And we've got a team here at AOPA, Jim Kuhn and his team with our regulatory affairs group. And they're, like I mentioned earlier, they're on Capitol Hill every day, both with the lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and in both houses, as well as with the FAA directly and working closely with them to try to navigate and push these things forward in the face of all the turbulence that they're wrestling with these days.
Let's latch on to that for a moment on the topic of changes in Washington and how it might affect general aviation. One of the things certainly is there's obviously a big focus on cost savings in government, things like that. In the past, when those words have come up in association with aviation, the words privatization and ATC fees have always come around. Do you see that as a current risk?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, there have been some think tanks out there, Cato Institute and others have directly come out in the last month or so, month and a half, and explicitly called for privatization of ATC, which is no different than was done whatever it was, 8 or so years ago, last time around. So, there's absolutely a real risk that topic comes back up. Now, we did just submit a letter, basically to Congress, to the FAA, that signed by basically everybody in the industry, including the airlines. So this was, I think, the big, the big accomplishment of this collective aviation industry group was to get essentially everybody across the industry to stack hands and say that we all agree that there's opportunities for efficiency with the FAA, opportunities for modernization and better deployment of technologies that would help them do a better job and be able to basically be more modern. Today, they're operating on legacy technology. We know we have controller shortages. We agree with the FAA and others out there who speak about the controller shortages. That's very real. Facilities consolidation, multi-year funding. There's a lot of things that could be done that would meaningfully improve the ability of ATC to support the airspace as we have it today, while preserving what's great. We have the safest airspace system in the world. So let's not throw that away. We can do all of that without having to go do privatization. So that's our argument, is that let's team up and focus on driving the improvements rather than spend the next year battling over whether to privatize or not privatize. And we think, given the amount of alignment we've got across the industry, our hope would be, and this is what we're obviously pushing, is that the members of Congress would lean in and support this position and basically partner with us and partner with industry to go work with the FAA to get this done, right? Rather than battling for next, you know, X quarters or years.
Do you also think that some of the changes happening with kind of the political winds right now affect the deadlines or kind of speed towards the elimination of 100 low-let?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we're not going to assume that just because there's a new administration in power that, you know, that the 2030 date that's been put out there to get to an unleaded fuel is going to change. It could, but I personally think that would be, it'd be foolish of us as an industry to just bet on that, because the reality is we really should get to an unleaded future. Yeah. I want to get to one that's as close to a drop-in replacement to 100 low-let as we possibly can. But having run lots of engines on unleaded fuel, including aircraft engines, they do run really well. You know, in Rotax, you saw the Sea Ray in the earlier picture. That's 100 hours between oil changes if I run unleaded fuel. It's 25 if I run low-let, 100 low-let. And so, you know, and we ran the Baron on GAMI fuel, the AOPA Baron on GAMI fuel. The engine ran better. The fuel, the wear metals in the oil were better. So the engine would typically last longer because we're not wearing it out as quickly. So there are lots of benefits. Obviously, the key question on all the low-let or all of the unleaded fuels that are just beginning to emerge is really around, you know, do they have the proper detonation or anti-detonation properties, which is where you get into the, you know, the additives they have to use to, in place of the lead.
But then also,
and that's the second one, the materials compatibility issues. Are all of these fuels truly able to be dropped in without any meaningful materials incompatibility? And that's where we're still early days on these things. Obviously, you know, GAMI's been out there. They've got fuel in California. They've got an STC. It's been approved in a very large number of airframe and engine models. They've had some issues out there. I think it's widely reported on various, you know, various outlets, AvWeb and others, around some of the paint and O-ring and tank sealant issues. And so, you know, the question, of course, that raises for all of us is, are those one-offs? Are those unusual situations? Are they, is there a mitigation option? Was there something wrong with that batch of fuel? Or if nothing wrong with that batch of fuel, was it something about those specific planes? If it wasn't those specific planes, if this is more of a universal issue, is there a mitigation option, either a tuning of the fuel itself or something that can be done to those aircraft so that owners don't have to go through that? Because clearly, if you're going to put a new fuel in your plane and it has immediate paint issues, that's a major red flag. And so I know George Braley and GAMI are working on providing answers to the industry on exactly those questions.
Yeah, and George is working really, really hard on that. Have a lot of respect for him in that regard. And I think there's some speculation that it's one of those things where, systems that are in really good shape, bladders that are in good shape, sealant that's in good shape, all the other kind of vulnerable components that are in really top shape should be fine, but will that translate into, I think, vulnerabilities for those things that already sort of have pre-existing issues? And with a fleet that's over 50 years old, I think that probably is quite a bit of it, if that is
true. It's why there's a strong narrative out there around ASTM and the standards-based consensus standard, basically, that has a, call it different. Some would argue it's a higher bar. Some would argue it's just a different bar. But it does require a level of industry engagement to understand all the materials compatibility issues that any given fuel might have in order to expose whether there are certain types of materials, or to your point, age of materials, where the compatibility is not what we'd want that to be. And then if that turns out to be true, what do you do about that, right? Does that mean you have to swap out your fuel tank sealant, or does every aircraft with a fuel bladder that's more than 20 years old need a new fuel bladder, or is it just about swapping out O-rings? What exactly is it? And so there's definitely a strong group out there who are, you know, very vocal around the importance of ASTM, because STC allows a producer to go faster for sure. And you'd expect if you were a fuel producer going down the STC route that you would be obligated as well to do as much testing as you possibly can. And I know George has done a lot of testing with GAMI. It's still a different approach to testing than, say, ASTM provides. on top of that. And so that's the approach that Swift, for example, is going down, where they're doing STC as well for the same reasons, I believe, that the GAMI is. But then they're also doing ASTM to add that additional level of, you know, of oversight, let's call it, on that. And then there is the PAFI process. You have STC and PAFI. PAFI is the government-funded testing, testing group, the Piston Aviation Fuels Initiative. And Lyondell is in that process. So that's one where you've got a government testing agency that's testing the Lyondell fuel in order to come up with a fleet authorization if the fuel passes the basically the test matrix they've got. And all of those have a materials compatibility requirement that goes with them. So what we're pushing for at AOPA, you know, we don't feel it's right to put our thumb on the scale and say one fuel is better than another. They all have to pass an FAA authorization in order to be approved for use in aircraft. So we're basically defining that as the standard from our view, but then we're going to put our money where our mouth is and make airplanes available to test it. But then also we absolutely expect that any of the fuel producers will be highly transparent with what they're learning to make sure that if they do discover issues, they jump on them quickly, they expose them to the to the market so we can see what they're doing, and then they offer up, you know, remediation or mitigation if there is an issue. And then I think over time the market will define ultimately, you know, who's the player or players that will win. And you know, it's still an open question whether we can have multiple players or whether there's going to be a winner takes all. And I think that'll really come down to whether the fuels themselves are compatible with each other or not. Right now they are considered not necessarily from a chemical reason, as I understand it, because I've spoken to most of them at this point, but more from a philosophical reason. And there's a difference in way each of these fuels achieve their performance. And so there's a desire from each of the fuel manufacturers not to have their fuels mixed with the other fuel. And for no other reason, it clouds the performance of any one fuel. If there are issues, it's hard to discern was the issue because of fuel A or fuel B. So each of the fuel providers is asking their fuel to remain independent. Doesn't mean that someday they couldn't be mixable, but for right now, that's not the path those fuel producers are on. And they're all independent companies, so they get to decide that at this stage, and they're putting their own money behind it.
It's funny. It's interesting because they're all compatible with 100 low lead, but they don't want to be compatible with each other.
At least not
at this moment.
Yeah, if they end up being compatible, which again, from my understanding, is less of a chemistry question and more of a strategy question, frankly, and concern. You know, they each have concern with each other's fuel, but you know, discerning how much of that is you know, true concern versus, you know, they're each advocating, as you'd expect they would, for their fuels, and they've got millions of their own dollars they put behind trying to get a solution. If they end up being compatible, then you could presumably have multiple fuels in the market. I don't think we'll see a situation though where any given airport or FBO carries multiple of these fuels. Just having now spoken to multiple FBOs and airport managers, Certainly. It's just too much money to put in multiple tanks. And so they'll end up picking a fuel that they want to stand behind. And again, if they're compatible, that's fine. Someone could pick Swift someday, someone could pick GAMI, someone could pick Lyondell, and you'd just show up in whatever airplane you had and you'd fill it with whatever fuel is available. If they're not compatible, then it kind of has to become a winner takes all, in which case that's why there's so much pressure and competition between them, because they all want to get out there as fast as they can and try to win that market. And at the end of the day, we're supportive of that with the condition that they are, you know, not getting out over their skis in terms of getting a fuel into people's hands and turning them completely into test pilots. And all of these fuels have been tested. George has run his fuel and his Cirrus and other airplanes. And I've met with Chris DaCosta up in Purdue at Swift, and they've got engine test stands and they're running their fuels in multiple airplanes. And obviously they've got 94 UL that's in many locations around the country. And the only distinction between 94 UL and 100R, which is Swift's 100 octane version, is the additive they put in there to get it from 94 up to 100. And they use a different additive than GAMI's using. So it's a, you know, it's a different fuel chemistry for sure between those two. And then Lyondell, I haven't seen as much. They're earlier in the stage, but I have spoken to a pilot who uses the Lyondell fuel in his twin turbo Lancer Legacy air racer. And so far he's had very good results with that. So, you know, there's promising momentum on all fronts. There are some, I'll call them hiccups or issues that need to be addressed. Some of the earliest fuels are getting real market traction. And I do think that, you know, the manufacturers need to get out there quickly when something like that happens and understand what the root cause is, so that pilots can make informed decisions around, you know, what fuels to use and what true risk are they taking on? Yeah. The intention would be no risk, ideally. The FAA has leaned in and blessed these fuels. But as we have seen, including with the AOPA Baron, it wasn't perfect, right? The engine ran great, but we did have some leaking in the Baron with our fuel tanks. And to your earlier point, those were 40-year-old bladders that we had the leaking in. But that's not that uncommon. Exactly to your point a few minutes ago, there's a lot of airplanes that have that. So
yeah,
how do we as an industry make sure we don't, you know, don't impose a bunch of costs and problems on pilots until we're confident we've got the materials compatibility worked out?
I think the other point, which is important, is regardless of what happens with our regulatory tolerance for lead in the country, we need, I think, to protect our fuel source. We need to be very proactive because, as you know, there's one single company that produces the tetraethyl lead, the TEL, over in England. And without them, there's no 100 low lead.
Yeah, I think that's why I do have some people, you know, hey, the amount of lead that gets put into the atmosphere is de minimis. It's a red herring. It's a rounding error, which is largely true, right? The amount of fuel we put, the amount of lead that general aviation puts into the atmosphere is very tiny. If you look at the amount of lead put into the atmosphere, if you go back to the 1970s to where we are now, you couldn't even see general aviation on that chart. It's dropped by so much. That being said, it's widely also agreed that there's no amount of lead that is considered good lead. And two, to your point, there's only a single supplier of that tetraethyl lead. They are over in Europe. I joined as part of the Eagle Group. We talked to them, and you know, they've committed to continuing to make that product through 2030. So there's no reason to believe it will disappear before that deadline. But it's also very clear their intention is to shut that plant down and do other stuff. That's a giant, you know, lead-producing plant, not a great environmental thing for them. And it's a tiny market, right? It's a really small market around the world, not just the U.S., but even the whole world. And so it's really not worth it to them to keep going. So they've committed to keep us going until we have the alternative, but they're all assuming that we'll have the alternative by the date we said we would, which is 2030. And so I think all of us to go fight and say, let's just keep 100 low lead and fight the battle about it being a small amount of lead, it doesn't account for the reality that lead is going to go away, whether we like it or not, at some point. And then we're really holding the bag because then we've got no options. So that's why, to my point, even if the EPA stuff were reduced a bit, let's say it's under the current administration and we took some pressure off all of us, we're making so much progress at this point and we're so close. We got three fuels, all three of which feel like they absolutely could solve the problem. You know, why not get one of those at least, if not all three of them, across the line and just eliminate this whole conversation? Because as you and I both know, Jeff, we talked earlier, you know, people have tried talking about noise as a reason to either shut down an airport or reduce the amount of traffic. And that's had certain modest or minimal effect for many places. Some places it's had more than others. But, you know, lead is a much more powerful narrative for the non-flying public to use. And it just means more battles that we have to fight rather than fighting to promote and expand aviation. A lot of energy goes into fighting to just preserve and protect general aviation. And, you know, I personally would rather be fighting and spending my energy on trying to grow it and bring more people into it, like we talked at the beginning of this, than spending time in court talking about why airplanes aren't as noisy or why we have a right to be there or why the lead that's coming out is not enough to care about. That's right. Just not a good way to spend our time.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about that has to do with the survival of general aviation and the growth of general aviation is, of course, you know, AOPA, Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association. And there's no M in that for mechanics. But the reality is, of course, I'm a mechanic. You've done a lot with your own work on your own planes. And we have a crisis in this country having to do with that. And we, if we can't support these aircraft, we can't fly them. And what do you look forward to in AOPA? What do you think, what role can AOPA do and play in order to help this situation?
Yeah, there's probably more we can do. We are doing some stuff already, though. Notably, we've got a high school program that's out there that's in over 1,100 schools now. There's 30,000 kids in that program today as we speak. There's been 100,000 that have gone through it. And that program isn't just focused on pilots. It includes mechanics as well. And so there's a whole maintenance track with the goal being to introduce kids to that whole world of opportunity in front of them. And it's more of a trade school route, which we know for many kids is exactly the right kind of route. Not everybody needs to go off to college. And so the idea would be, hey, there's a lot of opportunity in aviation and a way to make a good living in aviation by becoming a mechanic. And so we educate them on what that looks like and what the paths are to go and do that. So we do that. And then it's likely we'll add coverage. We have this pilot protective services that we offer to members today, which includes medical and legal services. If you're a member of AOPA and you have questions around either some medical concern you have about yourself, or maybe you violated the edge of a TFR and you've got a friendly letter from the FAA, we have services that will help you navigate that and be your advocate. And so one of the ideas we have is, why don't we add mechanics to that? Because if you're a new A&P, there's a certain liability, or IA for that matter, that comes with being that. And why wouldn't we offer those same kinds of services to a mechanic to just make it easier for them to get into that industry and be that, and know that they've got an ally in the back court to help them with in this case, legal related questions. So we're doing those, but beyond that, there's probably more we could do. Sort of the genesis of your question was, are we doing enough? And I think the answer is probably no. It's really become a much clearer gap in the industry, even just over the last few years, than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. And now I can't go to a single town hall without somebody asking exactly that question. And how do we solve this lack of mechanics as quickly as we can? Because it is becoming a major bottleneck.
It really is a challenge. And I think one of the biggest challenges is, quite frankly, general aviation does not have a mechanics organization, right? That's all about the airlines. And when we talk about making, there's a school that trains mechanics right at my local airport. And they're not coming out of that school and working on Bonanzas, Pipers, and Cessnas. They're getting scooped up and getting great jobs working for the airlines.
Well, it's the same challenge that flight schools have too, where the instructor gets in there, they hire someone, or they become a flight instructor, they last for maybe a year, and they get sucked off to the regionals. The mechanics that I know and speak to, the local FBOs and local maintenance shops that work on the Bonanzas of the world, have the same challenge, where a lot of their mechanics are being scooped up and sent to the airlines because they have such an exodus of old and retiring mechanics. And so you're right, it's the same challenge of, how do you get that small town, general aviation oriented maintenance shop access to the talent, and then be able to hold on to the talent so the money they put into training them and getting them up to speed doesn't just go completely go to waste 6 months later, right, when they move off to the airlines or somewhere else that perhaps is seen as more glamorous. So I think there's work to be done. I don't have the perfect answer, but I recognize the importance of the problem. And we've got a few little nuggets of things that will help, but I don't think they're enough to make as big a dent in the problem as we need to.
Well, I think having it on the radar is a great start, and seeing how AOPA can put its resources, in towards all of that. So let me ask you, obviously you're new to the position, a lot of things going on right now. What is it that you personally want to do, either different or new, or moving forward? What are your pet projects?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a couple that come to mind. One is, I think AOPA needs to do more to appeal to the young, the person who's earlier in their aviation tenure, let's call it, which on average would be a younger person, but doesn't have to be. We have a lot of people who join AOPA in their 40s, and a lot of it's around a career change. They ended up going down some path in life that maybe wasn't exactly what they wanted, but for whatever reason, they got forced into that or found their way. And then they'd always dreamed of being a pilot, and they make that career shift. They have the courage, in a sense, to step into a career path that excites them, and they end up in aviation. So we have that group coming in. I would still call them early in tenure when it comes to aviation. And then, of course, the vast majority of those folks are in their late teens, early 20s, who've made a decision perhaps to go to the airlines. And there's a lot of programs out there today to help them do that. I want to make sure we've got a value proposition, a reason for them to join AOPA. It used to be you'd join because we had great advocacy in DC and at the local airports and local state level, which we do. It's still, I think, as good, if not better, than it's ever been. But not everybody joins for that reason, like perhaps we all used to. Also, we have an amazing magazine. We have multiple magazines. It is really good, but the younger generation today doesn't read magazines as much as most of us did when we joined. So we need to change what we offer, in my view, to that younger population, take advantage of digital tools. I don't want to lose our long-term members, so the magazine's not going away. So I think for many of us, I love the magazine. This will be an and. Keep serving the existing members and doing a great job with providing value to them, but then tune what we offer to be more in touch with earlier in tenure folks and through digital media. And I would think if it's, you know, ways to help them find co-pilots, right? I know I'm always looking for someone to go with me when I fly, if I have an empty seat, because people did that for me and it paid off so much. I got so many hundreds and hundreds of hours in cool airplanes I could never afford to fly in myself. And so, you know, AOPA could create a path to doing that, right? To helping bring to life these various aviation careers. People see airlines front and center. That's a pretty easy one to see because we all fly on airlines. But what about cargo? What about medevac? What about power line patrol or firefighting? There's so many different dimensions of aviation. I think AOPA could bring that to life. And then lastly, I don't think we do enough, and I'd like to do a lot more of just educating the broader non-flying public on the value of general aviation. Most of them, unfortunately, and we've all heard this, you know, think of general aviation is it's either the rich guys playing with their toys, you know, or it's the rich guy dumping lead on my kids, right? There's some version of that narrative, which is not particularly positive, nor is it true. It's not even remotely true, because the reality is that most of these small airports, you've got, you know, flight training going on, which are usually young people who are on their way to, you know, an airline career. It is medevac flights are happening out there. Could be crop dusting or agriculture. It could be firefighting. If you happen to be, you know, if you were in Camarillo or Oxnard, California, a month and a half or so ago, you know, you would have seen nothing but firefighting aircraft taking off from those airports, heading down to Malibu and around the whole Hollywood area. And so, you know, thank goodness we've got general aviation airports that support those kinds of activities. We just never tell those stories. It's rare that the community knows that those things are happening. And so I think AOPA could do a much better job of getting those stories out around why general aviation matters and why that small GA airport in your town matters. And then arm the local folks. We have a, you know, multi-thousand airport support network group of volunteers within the AOPA family that help us, you know, fight the battles at the local level. And so we want to arm them with these stories and then augment those stories with true local stories. Here's, you know, Susie, who just graduated from high school, just got her private on her way to the Air Force or on her way to the airlines, and have people understand that those local airports actually do great things in their community. Yeah. And as someone said at a recent thing, you know, it's we'd like to have, you know, one message, many voices. And so I think we can play the role of what is that one message, and then arm everybody, the many voices out there, to tell us so more people appreciate general aviation.
Well, I really resonate very much with what you're talking about. Those ideas are fantastic. I think certainly AOPA championing the idea that you could, share flights and connect and get more exposure during your training or just in general would be a fantastic thing. That put a big smile on my face. The other thing when you talk about raising our profile and understanding is all about engagement. And I'll just pass along that what we've seen through Social Flight and all the events that keep happening all over the country that we draw attention to is that when airports have events that bring the local population in, especially when they do things like, airplane and car shows, where they open the fence and they have people there and you get people, you know, crossing over interests and walking around, the engagement happens and the conversations happen. And that's when all of a sudden they realize, oh, this isn't just a bunch of elitist rich people. This is like all cool people, and they get engaged. And maybe now, instead of complaining about the plane that's flying over their house, they're like, you mean my son might be able to just come here and learn how to fly, or you'd be able to take him up even for free, and maybe someday he might get interested. Like I've witnessed those conversations, and I've seen those hearts and minds change in their perspectives. And I think a lot of it is event driven.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, there's a saying another friend of mine has that you got to see it to be it. And, we don't do a good enough job of helping people see it. Like how most people don't know, you can just go out and become a pilot, go to the local airport, become a pilot. We have people I've come in touch with even more recently that, you know, assume that most airline pilots, you know, went into the military, got trained for a decade, and then ended up at the airlines. That was how it happened decades ago, but that's not how it happens today. The vast majority of flight training is happening at a local airport nearby in a 172 or an RV-12 or pick your favorite airplane. And then that's the value of these general aviation airports. It's producing the airline pilots of the future, as well as medevac, firefighting, and all those things we talked about. So I just think if more people understood that, there'd be a lot more, you know, support, right, for the investments that get made in airports. And I think if we do that well, the pressure on these airports to have to do things like the landing fees and use ADS-B for those purposes goes down somewhat. And then we can work with them to say, what are the other ways you could make money on your airport that don't require doing things that reduce aircraft activity. So what about more hangars? What about more compatible use development around the airport, light manufacturing and so on, that produce a property tax base and produce an employment base that drives the economics of the airport up while also promoting activity that drives, you know, that drives economic vitality. So I think us telling that story in a way that's far more far more concise than we've collectively done, and also is more widespread, because any one person can do it in their own town. If we could have that be something we spread across the country to understand the value of this amazing place, because one thing I've learned is in those jobs at Google and McKinsey and Cisco, and so I traveled the world extensively. I've been almost to every country in the world at this point, and that's given me an extreme appreciation for how good we've got it in the U.S. The general aviation industry and aviation overall, not just general aviation, is so much more vibrant and innovative here in this country than it is anywhere else in the world. And we shouldn't take that for granted. It could easily go away, and there's forces every day trying to diminish that. And so I feel like that's our opportunity. And AOPA's got the scale to do that. And we work really well. I work well with Jack Pelton at EAA and with Ed Boland at MBAA and with Pete Bunce and soon Jim Viola at Gamma and so on. There's all these groups. If we come together, we have a lot of influence. And so it's just about, you know, pointing that influence in the right direction.
Absolutely. The last thing I want to make sure that we do not miss here at all is tell me about your book, True North. Oh.
Yeah, that came out of, I recognized when I was at McKinsey, after I'd been there for a while, and McKinsey is a great place. I loved it. It was an amazing learning ground. I'm so thankful I was there. And I was surrounded by people who were incredibly competent, capable people that gone to some of the best schools, incredibly bright, incredibly driven. And I frankly had come from a very different background. I'd come from, you know, public schools, and so I'd followed a different path. I was a bit of a, you know, an anomaly in there. But despite that, ended up doing well and being there for quite a few years. But I was surprised by how many people, by all accounts, who should be living amazing lives, had gone to the best schools, working at an amazing company, incredibly smart and talented, living in a safe, amazing neighborhood, getting paid well, were not that happy with their lives. And I was contrasting that with people I'd been exposed to over my own journey, who perhaps made less money or had gone down different paths. And some had gone to very good schools. So it wasn't a good school versus a bad school. It was a mindset. What was it about some people that just had them lit up every day? They'd get up in the morning and be excited about the journey ahead. And I was surrounded by people who I thought should have that mindset, but didn't. And so it started this thought in my mind around, what is it about people who live inspired and fulfilling lives? And I ended up using those two words on purpose too, because inspired to me meant you wake up in the morning and you're excited about the journey ahead, right? You just can't wait to take on what you're working on. And fulfilling was you wake up in the morning and you look back at your life and you're fulfilled. Like if it were to end today, I'm happy with the life I've led and the contribution I've made. And the people I was most personally inspired by were the ones who had done both. They'd really led their life in a way consistent with who they are, or who they were, and then we're doing things consistent with leading an exciting life going forward. And I look for that across lots of areas. I found a lot of it in aviation. So the book, you just had the picture of it. The book is has a lot of aviation in it. It's called True North, as the picture here shows. But it's not just aviation. I've got business people in there, athletes, entertainers. I tried to make sure it wasn't just an airplane book. I wanted to find people across all walks of life who had done incredible things and lived both a fulfilling and inspired life. And it's basically the reason I called it a handbook for inspired living is it's learnings that are very easily applied, like a handbook would be. You can read chapter 2, then chapter 6, then back to chapter 4. There's an arc to the story, but you can jump around and take nuggets from each one. So it's an easy read. And it's great. It's gotten amazing feedback. It's on Amazon. I don't make a lot of money off of it. It's not about the money on the book. It's about the getting in the hands of as many people as I possibly can.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. And I love that you're able to take that kind of inspired journey of teaching people and then bring it all the way back to general aviation in the course that you're charting for AOPA. Well, Darren, we have one other thing that I want to see if you're game for. We do something at the end of the show called Social Flights Fast Five. We just questions about you. There are no wrong answers. So are you okay with going through five quick questions with me?
Yeah, lay it on me.
Okay. All right, Darren Pleasance, this is your Social Flights Fast Five. Five questions for people to get to know you a little bit more, especially in your new role as president and CEO of AOPA. And I'm going to start with question number one, which is starting from grassroots flying as you did at the airport, bumming rides and doing whatever you can through tailwheels, through so many jets, you name it, that you have flown. Out of all of that, is there an aircraft that's closest to your heart?
It's probably the Mustang, the P-51. And it's mostly because of the emotion it evoked. When I take somebody for a ride, especially if you take an older person whose father was either flew a Mustang or was in a B-17 and survived the war, perhaps because of the Mustang, the emotion that they get getting a chance to go for a ride is unlike any other airplane. So, and airplanes are emotional things, but I think the Mustang is probably the one that evokes that emotion the best.
Fantastic. I love that. And you know, you really can't beat a Mustang, but you're right. It's about the human impact of that aircraft. Okay. Speaking of human impact, question number two is, during all your years of flying, was there a particularly either scary or impactful moment in your life that you learned something from that translated to this?
Yeah. And we haven't rehearsed these, by the way, so it's a good question. I didn't know you'd do this, so this is fun. When I was Alaska Bush pilot, I had a charter flight with a Brinks guard. He had $1 million of cash, handcuffed, just like out of the movies, handcuffed in a metal briefcase. And there was a owner of a fish processing boat that was on the Seneca. I was taking it down south of King Salmon, which is out towards the Aleutian chain. And I was supposed to land at an airport down by where the fish processing boat was. Short version of this story, because I could take forever on it, is the fish processing guy did not want to land on that airport because he couldn't get to his boat. He wanted to land on the beach. I couldn't land. I didn't want to land the Seneca on a beach because it has tiny wheels. And so I landed. I found a little airport up above the beach. It was a little Native Alaskan village. And I landed there instead. I dropped off the Brinks guys at the other airport, then took the fish captain over and landed. And turned out the runway was about 700 feet long, which is not a long runway. I got the airplane stopped just fine, just at the very end, and it sank into the dirt. And he had been berating me, by the way, the whole time about, you know, why am I not landing on the beach? Every other pilot has landed on the beach. Why am I not doing it? And so he helped me dig the airplane out of the hole it had kind of dug for itself. I taxied back and I ended up taking off and just barely made it out of there. I was by myself, so the airplane was lighter at least, but I had both yellow lights on. If you ever flown a Seneca, I had overboosted the engines. As I got off the ground, I had to add all three notches of flaps the last second to get off the ground. I flew through the bushes. So there's this big zip of green, basically, that went over the wings and over the windshield and stuff. When I got back over to pick up the Brinks guys, I shut down. I didn't raise the gear because I knew I had gone through the bushes. And I got out and there were twigs and branches and stuff in the landing gear. The props were completely aluminum, no black left on the back of them. I had sucked up with all the dirt on this thing. I had sucked up so much dirt. It basically sanded the props down clean. And I was just really upset with myself because I knew I shouldn't have gone in there. I had to let this fish processing owner screaming at me in the plane convince me this was the right thing to do. And so that was the, you know, visceral memory of like, that's a dumb decision. I'm not ever going to make a decision like that again, where I let somebody else pressure me into doing something that I know is not right, but I didn't want to disappoint the customer in this case. So that was I got pictures of that one. That was, I got lucky.
Wow. That is a very, very good story and lesson for everyone. We've all done some things, but that's one that we're just glad that you're still here with us to tell that story.
Yeah, me too.
All right, question number three. If you could go back briefly in time, not to change something, but just to re-experience some truly special moment of flying, where would you put yourself?
Oh, probably it would be back up in Alaska. I did a lot of flying in the Caribbean when I had my jet job. We flew to the Caribbean every month. That was fun. But honestly, I think the best flying I've ever done of all the different types of flying would be my Alaska flying. It's just so diverse. It's so, desolate's the wrong word because desolate sounds kind of depressing. It's not desolate, but just as far as the eye can see, you know, there's nobody out there. It's just animals and wildlife. You feel like you've gone back, you know, millions of years in time when you're flying out in the outback or the bush out there. People are nice. It's just, nobody gets bogged down with a lot of stuff you do in the lower 48. It's just really about living. And so, and the flying is as exciting as you can get, you know, short runways, short and soft field runways, landing in on glaciers, landing on uphill runways at military bases, you know, seeing the northern lights. There's just, yeah, it just goes on and on and on, and it's so diverse. So yeah, and I only did it for one season. I've flown back up there many times since then, but not in that same job that I had that season. And so it would be fun. In fact, had the AOPA thing not come along, that was one of the things I was considering doing, is leaving my corporate world and starting back up and having the adventure of Alaska flying again. So I'll just postpone that for a bit and I'll go do it.
That's right. We'll be back in the role in 1 year. We'll see Darren back in late 26.
Exactly.
Okay, question number four. If you could go back in time and give some advice to your younger self in your teens or 20s, what would you say?
Yeah, I'd say don't sweat the journey, right? I think this is a big message to lots of parents these days who I see putting huge pressure on their kids to figure out, you know, what do you want to be, Johnny or Susie? And I didn't really know what I wanted to be. And I thought I would be an engineer, which is why I was getting my degree in engineering. But I also knew I loved flying. And to my parents' credit, they were really okay with me picking a path through life that amplified or indexed heavily on things that I was self-motivated to go do. So I went to UC Santa Barbara, not because I had a great engineering school, although they do have quite a good engineering school, but it was a good engineering school next to an airport. That was the most important factor. I knew whatever I did in college, I wanted to have it be close to an airport. And my parents were great with that, right? They thought that logic made sense. And man, am I happy I did that, because it allowed me to go to class and then ride my bike down to the local airport and teach, you know, during school, and then eventually charter work and Travolta stuff and all the things there. So yeah, I think it would be, there's no way I could have predicted that I would get my degree in engineering, right? Become, you know, fly for John Travolta, become a corporate jet pilot, go to Alaska. There's no way I could have predicted this whole journey. And so it was more about just being confident that if you lean into things that you enjoy doing, you'll probably do them better than the average, because you'll spend more time. I would read every magazine. I'd spend as many hours at the airport as I could. And I think if you are doing anything where you're likely to be better than the average person at it, you can make a meaningful part of your life, you know, out of that. And for me, that happened to be aviation. For others, it could be music or dance, or, you know, pick your favorite thing, or science, or whatever it might be. And so I guess that's it. I don't be overly worried on exactly how the journey is going to turn out. Just, you know, it's almost like take one or two steps forward, always just be moving forward and making progress around things that get you excited, and then wait and see what doors open up, and then just have the courage to step in. There was a saying that was given to me years ago that played a huge role in my journey. And the saying was, when faced with a difficult decision, choose the one that makes for a better story. And that really resonated, because like when I quit McKinsey to go join Google, that was, you know, I liked McKinsey, and I had figured out how to be effective there, and it was a good job. And walking away from that to something I knew very little about was scary. Or walking away from graduate school to go to Alaska and start knocking on doors, not knowing if I'd actually find a job. Those were all scary, but it was true that each one of them, if they worked out, would absolutely make for a better story than just continuing to do the same thing tomorrow that I did today. And so and even AOPA, I was doing great at Cisco. I love Cisco, amazing company. But what would make for a better story? Well, coming to AOPA and doing this for a while. So it's been a very powerful quote for me.
That I now have a new favorite quote. Thank you. Thank you for that. For faced with a difficult decision, choose the one that makes for a better story.
Yeah,
I love that. That's absolutely fantastic. Speaking of choosing, our last question on Social Flight's Fast Five: if you could choose anyone to spend an evening with, alive or no longer with us, past, present, doesn't matter, is there someone that comes to mind?
Yeah, you know who it probably be? You'd think it'd be a pilot. You think I'd say like Charles Lindbergh or something like that, and those would be really cool people to spend time with. But I think it would be Teddy Roosevelt. Because had you asked me a question in this interview around what's my favorite book, I'd probably say Theodore Rex, which is about Teddy Roosevelt and how he became president and what he did as president. Maybe partly it's because of our current political climate and how dysfunctional, you know, we are overall, left and right side of the spectrum. And I looked at what he did in terms of like true leadership. And it's a page-turning book. If you ever read Theodore Rex, you just can't help put it down. But you also realize what good leadership looks like. I'm an amazing leader. He took on the unions, so he battled the left and the unions. He also took on big business with Standard Oil and U.S. Steel and, you know, all the Carnegies and all that. And so he he did what was right for the country. It took a huge amount of leadership. And also he was a great adventurer, right? He started the national park system, big hunter, outdoorsman, self-taught, very curious person. So yeah, so I could spend an evening chatting with someone. I'd say Theodore Roosevelt. That would be amazing.
Absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Love that answer. Well, Darren, we could talk for hours and hours and hours. I hope you'll come back on the show in the future.
I'd love to.
And I just want to say thank you for taking time. I know how busy you are just having the new reins at AOPA, but I want to say thank you so much for taking time to join us here tonight on Social Flight Live.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, Jeff, and to the listeners who've tuned in. And obviously, I'm new in the role, so if people have ideas or want to lean in to help, I can't do this alone. And we've got an amazing team here at AOPA, but even that's not what it takes to do what we all need to do for general aviation. So hopefully others will raise their hand and lean in to help.
Absolutely. Well, you have a wonderful evening, and thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Jeff.
And thanks so much to you for everything that you do to support general aviation. And I appreciate you taking your time this evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday, March 4th, with James Spearman, Distinguished Flying Cross Award winner. He flew the United States Air Force KC-135, owns a GA maintenance shop. Really, really wonderful individual. James Spearman here, 8 p.m. Eastern time, as always, here on Social Flight Live. And then our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff. Go to cockpit, the number 2, and the word cowl, cockpittocowl.com, to register for that show. That's Tuesday, March 11th. We're going to talk all about autopilots. We're going to talk about tips, tricks, and traps. Everything you can imagine that can help you, both from the maintenance side, the operations side, flying, you name it, that is on cockpittocowl.com. And then on March 18th, we're back here on Social Flight Live with Commander William Patrick Driscoll, goes by Willie Driscoll, who is an amazing individual, was the first fighter ace during the Vietnam War. And went on to do so many other things as well. And so be sure to be here for that show, because that is something, it's a rare opportunity to spend some time with that amazing individual, Commander William Patrick Willie Driscoll. Until next time, thank you so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live. And I wish you all blue skies.